Ah, oh, there we go. Hello, everybody. I'm trying something a bit different today. We're actually doing a bit of a recording, but it's more of a live format thing because we're a bit lazy.
Yeah.
And it's using OBS and live switching is easier than, you know, editing in Premiere and stuff like that.
Shit, giving away the tricks.
Yeah, my little Premiere crash, assets are magic, yes. It's oh, dear. It's pretty good. It's pretty good for doing, like, more ambitious videos, which I'm hoping to work up to at some point. But
yeah.
But for now, we're just trialing these kind of short form things. So they will be a bit more like short streamy without being streams. I'm not sure if it's going to be every Monday, but these should consistently be going up maybe every other Monday. I don't know what we can commit to.
Yeah,
we'll
see. Just kind of see what happens, really. What time we have for them.
As you can see, I'm joined by our researcher and now perpetual guest. You're getting known as DG online, aren't you?
Yeah, I suppose.
It's kind of become your online moniker.
Yeah.
But enough preamble. We're going to be talking about the COVID war economy, because I stumbled on a whole bunch of weirdly mask-off shit.
Yeah, and it's also like a really great link to the stream from Thursday on Keynesianism.
Yes, well, it's a good link to basically all of the democratization series, and we'll be talking about it a little bit, but I haven't read Crisis and Leviathan, but there's a lot of stuff that's applicable here.
Yeah.
We'll probably recommend some Mises lectures at the end of this at some point, because there's a lot of very good resources about how kind of big events like a war or a pandemic and
terrorist attack yes.
Basically how your rights get eroded through periods of emergency power. It's very applicable here, so that's why, really just why I wanted to do this as it is. It's just also really, it's really funny to see the language of stuff like Francis flipped, as we'll see later on. It's like they're writing this from the other perspective.
Mm. Oh, no, I think, as we're about to get into it at some point, there might be a reason for this.
There may well be a reason for this, yes. But the first one we have here, and two of the articles we have, the two main articles, are from something called Foreign Policy magazine. Haven't really heard of them much before. I've probably seen their links online before, but maybe something a bit more in-groupy for people.
Yes, I don't think it's not something the average person would read. It's about like The Economist or something like that.
Yeah, it is. It's like the broadsheet for people who think they're a really shit Bond villain, maybe.
Ah, it's like the New European or something.
Oh God, no, that could be awful. But yeah, it's the title of this article, and this is actually from I think May of 2020, so this is over a year old now. This is looking at it kind of at the beginning of the pandemic period, and they're saying, you know, this is what a war economy would actually look like, you know, based on COVID. Yeah, leaders of the United States and Europe insist they're at war with coronavirus. Here's what they would do if they meant it. They go on to quickly mention the Coronavirus Production Act. There's a lot of waffle and preamble here. But the actual paragraph, or, you know, two paragraphs I want to highlight here, which are so incredibly mask-off that they kind of make
this
a jaw drop a bit.
Compared to some of the other stuff.
Yeah.
No, it sort of starts off suggesting that a genuine war against COVID-19 would not look like the hands-off, conservative, and woefully inadequate response of the Trump administration. Because, of course, Orange Man is always bad.
Orange Man always bad, yes.
But, you know, right within that short sentence there is the general notion we were getting from Keynes. You know, this notion that there are things that must be done by government because people would not do them themselves.
Yes.
And as it continues on, it's high time for the government to mobilise and coordinate all of its national resources to fight the pandemic and mitigate the shutdown's socio-economic costs. There is no better policy template than the war economies of the last century. It's almost like they understand that they've set a precedent with previous crises or something.
It is. It's very other end of crisis. It's here's how you properly take advantage of a crisis, dummies.
Mm.
It's here's how you properly erode people's freedoms. Yeah. It goes on to say, in a strange sense, it's precisely the current shutdown of large parts of the national and global economy that beckons the analogy to wartime economic organisation. Selective suppression of economic activity is fundamental to war economies. Which is, again, very...
Your rights mean nothing in regards to the cause, comrade.
Yeah, you've got to think about the actual logical implication of that language, though, because it just says, your business is secondary to these larger goals. And if we decide there is a crisis, there's nothing you can do about that.
You have become their means.
Yes. the relocation of capital, raw materials and people to factories for military industrial production and to the front lines required a deliberate demobilization of civilian economies in both World War One and World War Two. It's basically the Chinese bussing in unwilling peasants to the Foxconn factory.
The actual phrase, reallocation of people, that's incredibly a homo economicus sort of thing about, you know, we know what these people know best or should do best for themselves because they obviously don't understand it themselves.
Well, reallocation of people is also just like pure iron fist, you will go here or we will murder you shit.
Yeah.
It's labour camps is what it is. Yeah. Car manufacturers such as Renault in France and Ford in the United States stopped mass producing automobiles and began turning out tanks. Again, they see this as a good thing.
Mm.
comprehensive rationing also forced civilians to spend less on consumer goods. This suppression of the consumer economy increased household savings and encouraged the purchase of war bonds. It's just, it's amazing seeing this framed like this, because we went about it when we talked about the 1920s, and we're going to talk about when it gets to the 30s, about the default of the war bond, basically.
Yeah.
And how FDR robbed the nation of a huge amount of money.
But that's part of the thing that's sort of further mentioned in this article is that, you know, there is precedent already been set, especially by the American government, that they force, you know, they mention in here that car manufacturers took up taking tanks. No, they were kind of told quite strongly that you will build tanks or you won't operate. And when they did go and build tanks, they weren't then paid what they were told to, that were going to get paid for them.
Well, it's, again, something I don't want to spoil for the series, but once you get into the framework of this has to be a just war for them to justify this.
Yes.
You know, it's what happens.
There is no such thing as an unjust war.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. You know, they have to justify it. It's like, what if someone like General Motors had refused to manufacture for the US government over something like Vietnam?
Yeah, and it gets even more sort of mask off as it talks about, you know, comprehensive rationing also forced civilians to spend less on consumer goods. So they make this point about, you know, oh, well, they bought war bonds. Well, yeah, of course they bought war bonds because there wasn't the stuff they normally spent their money on anymore.
Do you want to read the next bit? Because this is the most mask off bit in this bit, I think.
In Nazi Germany, where the war economy was arguably taken furthest, they kept the trains on time. The Reich Economic Ministry and Reichsbank devised a sophisticated system of silent war finance as an alternative to raising taxes, which basically means running to the international financiers for money in regards to doing favours for them. Extreme rationing forced households to deposit their surplus savings in local banks. The banks then invested the surplus in government bonds and other debt instruments to finance rearmament.
They're framing this as a good thing.
Mm.
What they're saying is, we need to be more like Nazi Germany in fighting the coronavirus.
Yes, we should stop people being able to engage in consumerism in regards to the fact that they may need to actually buy or engage in certain industry to keep people in their community employed, and instead force them to pay for things we deem need to be produced because we deem the struggles.
There's also a little bit here where it says that, you know, neither price controls nor rationing has been introduced. It's almost indignant about that.
Yeah, there is no sort of question as to what these people want. These people clearly want more of it. You know, they have jumped at the first chance, especially this happening all the way back in May, to suggest that not only should measures be taken to increase production of goods they deem useful, they directly want to coordinate people's lives.
Yeah, they do. And they, like I said, they think that it's a good thing. It's like, and that's a good thing.
Mm. Well, no, it says as well, you know, there is complete economic illiteracy. In the next statement, as you talk about the price of N95 masks in the United States has jumped at least sixfold from $1 to $6 a piece. Now, the reason that happens is because it's, you know, there isn't a supply of them to sell at $1.
Yeah.
If you were to force the companies that make them to sell them at $1, there would be none left for the average person to buy. You know, the reason why it's so easy to hoard stuff in a certain sense is because the government forces the price down whenever a demand increase happens.
Well, it's the manufacture of a crisis, really.
Yes, no, it's precisely that.
And the next one we have here, while I just make sure the switchover works properly, there we go. This is the one that really sparked the idea of making this video, because I don't like doing look at headline and get angry at next headline.
Yeah, it's more looking at, as you know, especially an outlet like this, communicating essentially the next precedent or the previous precedents in a new form.
Yes, again, this is from March 2020.
Yeah, it's literally as the lockdowns were happening.
Yeah, and it's talking about, you know, the coronavirus war economy will change the world. You think this would be something on, like, you know, like Foreign Policy Exchange or maybe the Mises Institute that had this kind of title,
yeah,
talking
it's,
darkly
it's
about
almost,
it?
I'll not go into it because I can't remember the name of the outlet at the moment, but... Will Gregg used to work for them, I think.
I'm not sure, but I ain't sure about that one. It's kind of like having a headlines like the left wants to shoot you, and then having like a National Review be like, why we need to shoot Republicans?
Yes,
it's that kind of levels of what. There's the initial two paragraphs here are mostly they're kind of about the warlike language during the financial crisis. They talk about governments currently have, you know, managed public health emergencies at the same time as central banks act to calm financial markets. Armed forces are deployed to build hospitals and citizens' movements are restricted by social distancing. Again, they're talking about this in relatively neutral terms. This stuff isn't decried. Mm. But in what ways is the war economy useful to understand the fight against coronavirus? The idea has been invoked to mean a variety of things: productivity, sacrifice, reform, solidarity, which this article actually mentions quite a lot, and resourcefulness. In some of these areas, war isn't an appropriate way to think about the global pandemic. In other respects, however, it is. For Western governments to go beyond merely using wartime rhetoric. Yeah,
No, do you know what it is? What's come to my mind now? It's John Birch Society level written.
Yeah, it
and
is.
It's, you know, the bit at the start, just before what you were mentioning as well, you know, policymakers have become fond of using warlike language to describe their stabilization efforts.
Yes.
There is so many, you know, heavy ideological sort of terms going on there. And it's almost, you know, as you describe, it's so mask off for the fact that they are essentially engaging in a psyop.
Yeah. No,
in
its
purest form.
Well, they also say, you know, it's time for Western governments to go beyond merely using wartime rhetoric. Mm. What they're saying is, we need a war.
Yes.
Uh-huh. We need a war to change the world.
Yes, we need to create a further zeitgeist, because evidently individuals aren't subdued by the total state as much as we would like them to be so far.
There's a whole lot of waffle here about, you know, the DPA and prison labor. There's a lot of nods to leftist talking points, but where it really, really just gets just inescapably mask off to a degree that I have not seen.
The very term they use there is this sort of deterministic idea of the inescapable need for state involvement helps explain why their war economy is a favourite metaphor of the technocratic imagination.
Yeah.
I mean, what more do you need to hear? Crises have always granted reformist policymakers powers to bypass legislative gridlock and entrenched interests.
You know,
you as the individual will just be wiped aside as the great cause comes in and we all, you know, throw ourselves onto the pit, essentially.
Yeah, it's time to steamroller. Basically, what he's saying here is that, you know, democracy eventually gums up, because that's what it's designed to do, and then we use these crashes to pile-drive our agenda.
Say, the coronavirus crisis is already allowing the implementation of ideas that would have been considered radical just months ago. The speed with which the US legislators have embraced interventionist ideas such as direct cash transfer, freezes on mortgage foreclosures, and government nationalisation of distressed firms is a major intellectual vindication of the left. Which is essentially suggesting that, you know, they have every single tool of power to attack property,
yeah,
the free market, and the individual. And every single time they can come up with another fake crisis,
yeah,
to involve us all in, they will just do it again and again and again.
Well, no matter what the intention of the writer is, what they are saying is crises and the manufacture of crises vindicates the left, in quotes.
Yes, it's so backwards, but yet also so, like, sort of underwritten by humiliation. It's kind of almost ridiculous.
It's also underwritten by power politics. What it's saying is the more crises we can create, the more vindicated we can make ourselves look.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For a long time, the progressive left has highlighted the very problems the virus has now exposed. You know, it goes on to talk about, you know, precarious employment. Basically, they're using all these justification issues of the faults with their own system to be able to say there's an emergency going on right now. you know, we need to take away all of your freedoms and implement all of these redistribution efforts.
Yeah, we must engage in more social engineering to solve the problems that we identified before, because we can assure you that the current real crisis definitely accelerates these real problems.
But it gets worse. It gets even more mask off. It's, yeah, but successful crisis management is no guarantee of durable reform. War economies can be powerful incubators of political change. Here we go. But technocracy cannot make its offspring survive through its own power alone. What renders these innovations durable is the emergence of political and electoral alliances.
Yes.
It's like, again, it's like we're reading San Francis here.
But backwards.
But backwards, yeah.
Yeah, so somebody's read this and thought, oh, this stuff's brilliant. I know how I'm going to rule.
Yeah, that Leviathan guy. I'm on his side, you know? Go Leviathan!
Woo!
Waving little triangle flags.
Free horn and whistle.
Yeah, in the case of the European welfare state, the real fruits of wartime crisis management were only reaped after the end of the conflict.
Which is essentially an admittance of the fact that every time some event like this arises, they have no plans to go backwards from what they implement. You know, the rationing, the state involvement in the economy, the state direction of production. None of these things are ever ramped back.
Well, this is one of the only times I've seen that framed as a mask off positive.
Yeah, yeah, it's the ratchet exists and it's good.
Yeah, here's how we can intensify the ratchet. Let's make sure the ratchet doesn't move backwards, is what this is saying. It's amazing to see it couched in these terms. Yeah, policies meant to deal with the damage of the Great Depression and the wars created new constituencies. Despite being framed as exceptional wartime or post-war measures, many provisions rapidly became entrenched.
Well, no, that is, again, it's Francis. It's his idea of the post-bourgeois proletariat. It's the workers who are no longer tied to the factory owners because they are now just, you know, having to engage with faceless managerial sort of figures that ultimately have no real connection to them in any meaningful sense.
Yeah, in interwar Britain, France, and Germany, it was financial support for war victims, veterans, and those left widows, orphaned, and disabled by the war that created the foundations for later universal pensions and childcare. It's create war and create solution for war.
Yes, then use the disaster you create in entering the war as moral hostage for anyone who isn't willing to follow along with the policies. Oh, you can't be against these benefits. What about the people who were affected by the war? Because that is, you know, in future what we're going to see from the situation we are in. And as they sort of get into mention later on in this, things like UBI will not just be justified by the unemployment caused because of lockdown, but you will then become someone who is immoral or a pariah if you want to be against UBI, because think of the sacrifice these people made.
Yeah, if the emergency response to COVID-19 grow to encompass a large enough group, for example, the millions of service workers being laid off, this too may coagulate into a new semi-organised group with a future political role. They're talking about UBI there.
It's modern-day techno-serfdom.
It is, yes. Precisely because of their reliance on state action, war economies are deeply political systems. War economies do not suspend politics, they raise the stakes.
Consolidation abounds.
Yeah, it is, yes. As opportunities for empowerment and enrichment abound, novel distribution of benefits and burdens arise, in which some groups acquire power and resources, not just in excess, but at the expense of others. I don't get how someone's reading this and not going, am I the bad guy?
No, they're reading this and going, yes, we are the bad guys.
Short-lived emergencies can temporarily bracket distributional questions from political debate, for example, over wages. But the longer warlike expectations last, exceptions last, the greater the opportunities for subordinate groups to leverage their power. It's like Marxist dialectic there. What they're saying is we're going to create an emergency and we're going to posit ourselves as a solution and get the disenfranchised groups to do the heavy lifting for us.
Yeah, and then once we have abused them, we will then flip the rhetoric around and point the fingers at the very people we enrich through the process as the new enemies. I mean, we see this in the way that sort of Bill Gates went from becoming the hero of the world to a pariah in the space of months.
Yeah, in the early 20th century, war production made labour unions more powerful in basically the entire world. Even when organised labour negotiated pacts of national unity with governments and business interests, it put its power on display in immediate post-war periods of 1918 to 21 and 45 to 48, which was the largest strike wave in the 20th century.
We can see the same phenomenon that happens with a figure like Gates or a figure like Fauci nowadays. Clearly happened with Churchill.
Yes.
You know, Churchill was the man who they posited for, you know, a short period of time as the man who saved Britain, and then he became one of the most unpopular leaders, and then he became further entrenched through history as a racist and a xenophobe and a pseudo-fascist and all these sorts of things.
Yeah, so it's a way of reframing the conflict, and it is. What it did was it did create this period of like massive movement towards, you know, the quote-unquote organized labor is just a layer between you and, you know, more control. What it is it is there to manage you. It's a further layer of management.
Yeah, this is priming you for it, essentially.
Yes, it is. And
it's you giving them, or it's them giving you the guidebook or the structure of here's what happens next if you're clever enough to read it.
All this is talking about is here's how we can further the total state through a war economy.
Yes.
That's what this is, and they're not hiding that.
Well, no, they are hiding it, but they're hiding it behind language that only they know.
Yeah.
And this is the reason why they use terms like, you know, technocratic and, you know, empowerment, enrichment abound and all these sort of phrases, because ultimately, you know, they want to admit the truth.
Yes.
They are talking to their fellow managerialists or their fellow sort of political actors and making it known that this is the script, this is what we are doing now, follow along and you can be enriched and, you know, powerful just like us.
But I just, the way they talk about perpetuating the politics of crisis here in a positive light is, it's very rare that you will see someone attempt to do that, because they always at the time say this is not going to last forever.
Yeah.
And this is a justification saying, well, here's how we should make this last forever and here's why it should last forever.
It's basically just a big gaslight in a lot of ways.
It is. There's a lot of, and there's a few other things I came across whilst researching this. This can be, again, a bit of a shorter piece. Don't sit in for too long. You can probably see by the timestamp below that we're not going to be rambling you for 3 hours this time.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not, no. There's one from the World Economic Forum here which really talks about the globalization of the idea of the war economy.
Yes, it's not that our nations are at war anymore. It's that the globe is at war with a disease. You know, we are no longer fighting other men on shores in a way that we can think of. We're actually fighting something so amorphous and almost, you know, like the war on terror or something like that.
It is. It's very much the kind of a, the war on terror was a forever wars affectation.
Yeah, well, you know, here's another one here. And what worries me is what is then done with this sort of rhetorical power? I mean, are we actually going to be like the next, you know, the next global war is won against something from outside our solar system or something ridiculous like that?
Yeah, but we're getting, there's not really many other places to go with this, which is why you see a lot of people, as we'll probably talk about at some point, mention things like Bluebeam.
Oh, yes.
And projects like that. And, you know, it's kind of the ultimate area of where does the mass consciousness go?
Yes.
And how do you keep this train running?
Yeah, the train's on time.
Yeah, got to keep the trains on time. But this, again, is kind of the fruits of it. They talk about low-income countries. And we used to talk about low-income families within countries.
Mm.
It's, again, reframing this as, the global nation.
You shall not think about those around you because that is wrong. You must think of everyone. You must engage in some form of, you know, bastardized universalism.
There's also something I found as well whilst just googling it. What a good thing to do is if you see some of the mask off terms that they use, just start searching them up and see what else uses them. Because I found something here from Zenith, which is a big UK investment group, and a lot of this is a bit boilerplate, but they literally have a title here, and if you know what you're talking about, this should worry you as well. They talk about investing during a silent war.
Again, that phrase, that sort of understanding that we are at war with something we cannot see, and that only those who really know, you know, the technical experts, the doctors, the true elites and the technocrats, they know the enemy and they can fight them for us, but we just have to make ourselves serfs to them in the meantime.
Yeah, it's very much subsuming to a priestly class.
Indeed. The crusade, if you will.
Yes, the big old crusade here. I know, we've got a little discussion, unless there's something else you want to cover from the actual pieces themselves.
No, I think that's... I think if ever anyone wants anything else at them, they can go and have a look themselves, I suppose.
Yeah, they will be... I will link these either in a community post or just try and put them in a comment. You know, they will be linked down below, so look for a pinned comment. Or, yeah, it'll be in a pinned comment, and that'll link to, you know, either where they're linked to or link to them directly, if that waffle makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, here's really... These are the assumptions that are made that underpin... basically all of this thinking.
Yes, this idea of, you know, in the first article, this idea of national resources, as if resources do not belong to people that have ends and goals for them themselves. It is part of, you know, this idea of collective ownership and the collective management of private business, which is, we'll see in a moment, is not necessarily the case.
No, it's not necessarily the case, because these are private companies, and what they're talking about here is intervening. You know, we don't have nationalised manufacturers of, like, N95 masks. We don't have nationalised manufacturers of hand sanitizers.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But, you know, there is a sort of weird dichotomy or a weird dynamic there whereby, you know, they play on the egalitarian and almost sort of Marxist rhetoric to a certain extent, but then they go and create the very state capitalism and monopoly capitalism that they're supposed to be railing against, enriching, you know, the BioNTechs and the Pfizers and the Modernas of the world.
Well, the other underpinning assumption is this is a warlike crisis. They have to use the language of crisis by design. And they're almost alluding to that fact within the body of the text themselves. But there's never an examination here of, is this really a total war situation?
No, well, you can't question that. To question that is to essentially pull the whole thing down, because everything is predicated upon the fact that this is something bigger than you. You know, you aren't capable of dealing with this even yourself, amongst your local community, or as even just, you know, a nation of people anymore. This is a global crisis and a global effort.
Well, we put the national emergency superseding property rights and by extension personal liberty, but it's not, I've got that wrong there, it's not a national emergency,
well,
it's a global emergency.
It gets framed as a national emergency first.
Yes.
I think it's been since, you know, those first few articles, because again, the way it was framed in Britain, and a thing that you mentioned quite a while back was, you know, the revigorating of the quote-unquote Blitz spirit, old Blighty, and keep calm and carry on. All these very, you know, British cultural signifiers were entirely used against us, and then were reframed into the fact that, you know, it's not just us against this, we are fighting the global crusade against the global viral enemy.
Well, I think we should end here, really. There's a quote that you got up that's very good. It's from A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism. I'll get it up here on the other bit before I forgot. So I think it's page 36.
Yes, it is.
Again, there'll be a link, because it's actually a free PDF. Again, thank you to the Mises Institute guys. There's a lot of resources out there that are very worthwhile that are there for free.
Yes, but it essentially says, you know, declaring everybody a co-owner of everything solves the problem of differences in ownership only nominally. It does not solve the real underlying problem, differences in the power to control, which may seem slightly out of frame for what we're talking about. What this essentially suggests is that as each new thing becomes a public goal or a public crisis or a public property, the idea of ownership is in name only. These things, the control is transferred then to the bureaucracy, not the actual individuals that own and operate these aspects of business or these resources or distribution. And that the whole thing is underwritten by a sort of... The same thing as the Keynesianism thing from the other day is that, you know, you are not capable of fighting this. You don't understand what's going on because you are a pro.
It really just... Yeah, it also underpins the idea that public property isn't public property.
Mm.
And the argument for the COVID stuff is making more and more things public property.
It's a public healthcare crisis.
It is, yes.
You know, all these sort of notions. And that totally steps away from the fact that the only real way we solve problems in any meaningful way in society is amongst ourselves as individuals making meaningful decisions. And when each and every time some aspect of policy takes the ability away from us to make meaningful decisions, we no longer solve the problems. The problems are quote-unquote solved for us.
Well, all it does here is throw in the power politics stuff, in that it just says, this doesn't benefit you, this benefits those who control these resources. And, you know, you can make an argument that you magically own part of the motorway somewhere, but you don't control it.
No.
You can never make an argument for that.
You can't cut it up and take it home with you.
No, you can't. Oh, dear. But, yeah, that's kind of the what we want to talk about here, really. It's shorter form stuff. I'll probably figure out a better way to do outros and maybe get a fixed outro and, you know, do some more YouTube-y stuff with this.
Oh, like actual intros and maybe even burgeon into the realms of having an theme.
Oh, an theme is gay as fuck. I'm not having an theme. But I might do some like more end cards and have an actual recorded spiel. Because as always, links down below. You can join our channel. We are monetized. Blah, 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 blah. Donate, like, subscribe. Drop that comment like it's hot, guys.
Well, furthermore, you are now going to be writing pieces on the Substack profile.
Oh, yes. I will link that in the description. Because there should have been one that came out yesterday. No. There'll be one coming out tomorrow. I forgot how time works. Because these are going to go up on Monday, and I'm probably going to put that out on Tuesday.
Yes, I think that the plan with those is possibly write pieces that at some point either directly link or tangentially can be brought into either the long form series that we've been doing or some of the short form stuff.
Yeah, there's maybe be some companion pieces in there to videos that we do. Probably not this one, because this one's kind of standalone because it references other articles.
Yes.
But there will be some where there will be written and kind of visual format, which I think is a good way of doing things if people want both. But yeah, thanks for watching, and hopefully we'll be able to do these relatively consistently and keep them under a certain length.
Yes, we shall try our best.
But yeah, that's...
Goodbye.
Yeah, thanks for listening and goodbye.